Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Friday the 5th of December. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, Victoria passes adult time for violent crime laws. As children as young as 14 will now face adult court and jail terms. And why are several countries boycotting the Eurovision Song Contest next year?
They issued a new set of rules to their members, basically trying to mitigate any third-party or governmental interference into the song contest, particularly around voting, because that was a huge concern.
The Federal Health Minister has promised to introduce a new bill in Parliament to help take the sting out of pricey private health coverage. Mark Butler says he'll be forcing all specialists to make their fees public so private health insurance companies can keep their prices low and provide value for money. It follows a report from Australia's peak medical body that private health insurance is failing to deliver value for money to millions of Australians who own policies. Kathleen O'Connor has the story.
Australians are dumping their gold-tier private health insurance in record numbers because they can't afford the increasing fees. Melbourne resident Brian is one of those people struggling with the costs. He's 85 years old and needs urgent eye surgery.
If I don't have it soon, I'll be going blind. I've got to find $10,000, possibly more. This has got to be done in a private hospital by a private surgeon. It's all organised for next week. I'll rob a bank or something to find the money.
A new report by Australia's peak medical body claims private health insurance is failing to deliver value for money to the roughly 15 million Australians who have a policy. Dr. Danielle McMullen is president of the Australian Medical Association.
We've seen that private health insurance premiums are going up and up, which will be no surprise to Australians. And sadly, our coverage is being narrowed. We've got more policies with exclusions, and we've got more Australians choosing lower levels of cover, which has an impact on them when they go to try and seek care.
Dr. McMullen wants insurers to return 90% of what customers pay in premiums in the form of treatment benefits. At the moment, it's less than 85%. Rachel David is the CEO of Private Healthcare Australia.
Health funds need to run themselves as viable businesses, the same as any other insurance business. And that means some very hefty costs of doing business, like funding IT, cybersecurity, funding the call centres that provide people with the information that's legally required. I don't know of any insurance type that's able to pay out 90 cents in the dollar without going broke.
Currently, the average cost Australians are paying for private health insurance is $900 a month for top cover and $400 for lower tiers. That number is expected to rise by around 3.7% this year, the biggest increase since 2018. But it's a jump in price that needs to be ticked off by Federal Health Minister Mark Butler.
I said to insurers, I can't remember now whether it was late last year or very early this year, that that figure that had dropped from the high 80% to the lower 80% needed to jump back up. I said if it didn't jump to a level I thought was appropriate, I would look at legal options to force it. I've got the first applications, I think, coming through from health funds about increases they'd like to pass on to members in April. We'll kick the tyres very heavily on that.
The health minister agrees one reason for the skyrocketing costs of private health insurance is how much specialists are charging for their services. Some Australians are being charged as much as $1,000 for an initial appointment with a mental health specialist.
I think it is completely a rip-off sometimes because there is no rhyme or reason to it, just because some of them can.
And he's vowed a crackdown.
I'm going to require doctors to publish all of their fees. Now, there was a voluntary system introduced by the former government, but it's failed. Of the many, many thousands of specialists, literally only 70 publish their fees. Not 70%, 70 doctors publish their fees. Everyone else is still keeping it secret. So we're going to publish them for them. We've got access to them. We're going to put them all on the website.
Professor Yuting Wong from the University of Melbourne says specialist fees are not the only reason we are seeing increases in insurance premiums.
Well, it's some of the administrative costs. If you think about a lot of premiums we pay, maybe on average 84% of that used to cover medical claims, right? They are still a part that covers the personnel in the insurance company, the executive fees, and just the cost of running the business. So some of that, I think, could be a bit more efficient.
Professor Yuting Wong from the University of Melbourne there, ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. The Victorian Parliament has passed their Adult Time for Violent Crime Bill, which will see children as young as 14 who commit certain violent crimes face the adult court system and jail sentences. Premier Jacinta Allen announced the bill as part of a range of measures to tackle the youth crime problem in the state, with Victorian youth now facing some of the toughest penalties in the country. Advocates warn, though, that the sentencing measures are not the right approach and continue to lobby for greater prevention funding. Kimberly Price reports.
It was a shopping centre brawl in suburban Melbourne that turned ugly. And despite the fact the main culprit was 18, the Northland Centre machete attack became symbolic of Victoria's violent youth crime issue. In an attempt to curb the problem, children as young as 14 believed to have committed a violent act will now face adult courtrooms and some of the toughest penalties in the country. Jacinta Allen is the Victorian Premier.
This has come from listening to victims of crime, understanding that they've said clearly there's not enough consequences, which is why the work has been done to bring adult time for violent crime to the Victorian Parliament.
Dr. Xanthi Mallett is a criminologist at Central Queensland University and says Victoria's move puts it in line with Queensland's controversial adult crime, adult time legislation.
These are very, very significant potential sentences if judges were to go down the most harsh line available.
The tougher penalties extend to crimes like home invasion or injuring someone with a machete. Xanthi Mallett says the new legislation increases the bottom line judges have when sentencing youth.
What we saw previously was there was a real push to really deviate young people away from incarceration. This is stripping that away and is really saying that they want young people to know that life is genuinely a potential consequence.
She says research suggests longer sentences often lead to reoffending.
We know that young people, if they're incarcerated, especially if we're handing down very significant long sentences, actually become further criminalised.
Louisa Gibbs is the CEO of the Federation of Community Legal Centres and does not support the Victorian government's move.
If you are a 14-year-old, your brain has not yet developed in a way that helps you make decisions. So to apply a penalty that we would apply to adult decision making is inappropriate for children who do have the capacity to change their behaviour.
It's a very sad day, really, from our point of view.
David Murray is the strategic project lead of social change organisation Jesuit Social Services. He wants more rehabilitation options available for judges. However, he says many such programs have had their funding cut.
The government announced the funding of what was known as the Schools Focused Youth Support Service, which was quite a small but niche service which had youth workers and others working with schools targeting kids at risk. And that's just been wiped off the table.
Last month, the Victorian government did announce more than $27 million to fund the Violence Reduction Unit, based off Scotland's successful model, which rehabilitates youth offenders through school, hospital and employment programs. David Murray supports that model, but believes it alone is not enough to solve the issue.
It was a long-range strategy and it required significant commitment over some time. It's, what, $27 million an ounce? It's still a relatively tiny amount of money. And if you look at the erosion of the funding I mentioned before in terms of those community sector services, they're going to have to go a very long way even to get back to baseline in terms of what might be available to them to help.
Victorian Attorney General Sonia Kilkenny said in a statement that there are no easy solutions to youth crime and the best approach is always to stop crime before it starts. But she says the state absolutely needs serious consequences for violent youth crime to protect the community.
Kimberly Price. The families of the police officers murdered at Weambilla in Queensland in 2022 have launched legal action against the New South Wales and Queensland police. The families have lodged a claim for damages against police for nervous shock arising from alleged negligence, according to the court documents. The ABC's Josh Robinson has the latest. Josh, this legal action followed closely on from the coroner's report into the deaths of police officers Rachel McCrow and Matthew Arnold. What did the coroner say happened that day?
Well, the coroner said that the slayings of these two police officers, a neighbour, Alan Dare, by members of the Train family, Nathaniel, Gareth and Stacey Train, were the result essentially of a psychiatric condition, a delusional disorder that the trio shared. He found during, it was a lengthy inquest, he took a long time to come back with his findings. He was reluctant to attribute blame on the part of particularly the Queensland Police Force in terms of what happened in the lead up to this event, their investigation of peripheral matters and the conduct of New South Wales police in the same respect. He was reluctant to lay blame, though the inquest did hear certain information was not fully passed on to the Queensland police. And there were arguments that this was information about the level of hostility that Gareth Train in particular had expressed towards police, to family members, threats that he had made to family members in the lead up to this tragedy. And there are questions raised about how that would have informed how police went about going about this job. But again, the coroner was reluctant to attribute blame.
So why are the families themselves taking legal action against the New South Wales and Queensland police?
The families, according to court documents, are alleging that the fatal shooting of their loved ones would not have happened had there not been negligence by the Queensland and New South Wales police.
So what's likely to happen next in this case?
Well, I was speaking to somebody, a lawyer familiar with the inquest proceeding, and they suggested that the Queensland police is very unlikely to want to see this go to open court and for these matters to be ventilated. I'm extremely traumatic, even for the two surviving police officers who were there that day, Keely Brough and Randall Kirk, but also particularly for the families. The process here with this claim is that it has to go to a compulsory conference, and it would seem very likely that the police service would try to settle these claims in private and not see this matter aired in court.
ABC reporter Josh Robertson. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. For the first time, the Australian government has released a full data set on neurological conditions in the country. The report, published today by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, captures the number of Australians living with neurological conditions and their impact on the health system. In 2022, an estimated 2.2 million Australians suffered at a cost of $6.6 billion to the country. And experts believe those figures only just scratch the surface. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
15 days in every month, Zoe Milordis gets a migraine.
Typically, it starts on one side for me, it's always the left, and I'll experience at first pressure around my eye, and then that can also turn into some vision disturbance. I'll also get a lot of brain fog very soon as well, and then it really progresses from there into really severe throbbing pain.
Zoe gets pain in her neck and her jaw. She becomes sensitive to light and sound and struggles to complete basic tasks.
Communicate, write a message, stand up. Sometimes the pain that causes in my neck is just simply too much.
She's been living with migraines for almost 2 years and, like millions of other migraine sufferers, has tried everything from strong painkillers to frozen Cokes.
Unfortunately, I've had to go through quite a bit of trial and error. I've dealt with questions that seem to be completely irrelevant to a migraine, and I have also dealt with some kind of diminishing around my descriptions of just how painful and just how debilitating it is and how difficult the impact is on all domains of life.
Today, the Australian government is attempting to rectify some of those gaps, launching its first ever report on the number of Australians like Zoe dealing with neurological conditions.
This is the first time that data on prevalence, hospitalisations, emergency department presentations, disease burden and health system expenditure associated with neurological conditions is put together in one place.
Richard Hurley is the head of chronic conditions at the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, the government body that produced the report.
There are still lots of data gaps, particularly around migraine. We can see that a condition that impacts females much more than males, and it particularly affects people of working age in the 25 to 55-year-old category. So we particularly want to investigate and understand the economic impact of that is having as well as a health impact.
What they did find was that long-term neurological conditions impacts 1 in 12 Australians, about 2.2 million people, and around 1.7 million of those are migraine sufferers. Carl Cincinnato from Migraine and Headache Australia says those numbers are likely much higher.
I think it understates it, to be honest. We just did a survey with Jean Howes for Women's Health, and we surveyed 5,000 Australians earlier this year, and we found that migraine affects 30% of Australian women.
That's around 4.1 million women, and men suffer too. Carl Cincinnato says that underscores the need for reliable data.
Some women may think it's part of their menstrual cycle. They can have light sensitivity, nausea and vomiting, and they can chalk it up to hormones. Some men with migraine think it's sinusitis or sinus pain, and they're taking allergy medications. So I think once we get a clear picture on the prevalence of migraine and the impact, then that's when we can start to put in place some robust mitigation strategies to address it.
More broadly, neurologists like Professor Owen White says there's an urgent need for Australia to start documenting this.
The best available figures that I'm aware of at the moment for Australia, and they were published several years ago, indicated that between 13 and 15% of all presentations to doctors in this country were either neurological or psychiatric. With that, we don't see 13 to 15% of resources dedicated to neurosciences or neurology. We don't even see more than 2 to 3% of time dedicated to the teaching of neurosciences in any of our universities.
Neurologist Professor Owen White, ending that report by Julia Bergen. Three lawyers, including a King's Counsel, are facing a please explain from legal regulators after using artificial intelligence to create a document that contained false information. The case is in the Federal Family Court and it utilised AI to find references to case law that did not exist. While many states have provided guidelines for the use of AI in the courts, the federal courts are yet to release any guidance, as Angus Randall reports.
Lawyers seeking information to support their case use artificial intelligence to find one. The only problem is the information that comes back is fake. Tanya Sorden is an emeritus professor at the University of Newcastle's Law School.
AI is being used to help compile documents, summarise documents, create chronologies, and to gather material and present it in a format so that a lot of time is saved.
Three unnamed lawyers from South Australia and Victoria filed a document to the Federal Family Court containing inaccurate and misleading references to case law. Tanya Sorden says it's far from the first time AI has created a challenge for the court system.
There are now more than 600 cases worldwide. And it is a significant issue because what actually happens, because, you know, most Gen AI is oriented towards a people pleaser model, is that it actually makes up references and it makes up material. And so this is a significant risk in terms of the truth and the accuracy.
Many previous misuses of AI in the courts have been from people self-representing, not legal professionals. The SA lawyer has been ordered to pay more than $45,000 in costs. So if the risks of mistakes are so great and the costs so high, why would a lawyer use artificial intelligence?
I think because sometimes it seems so easy, and it's the same reason why university students use Gen AI as well. And it seems so plausible as well, even sometimes when you're working in an area, you have to go right back and check the references.
Lawyers are using AI programs designed for the legal profession, rather than just typing something into ChatGPT. But there is still the risk of a mistake from either the AI or the person who should be double-checking its sources. Professor Michael Legg is the director of the Centre for the Future of the Legal Profession at UNSW.
Because we rely on precedent, they need to be able to say to the court, look at this case or look at this legislation or these regulations. This determines the way in which you should decide this case. It's that last part where people are looking for the sort of authoritative statement of the law that hallucinations in generative AI have caused a lot of problems. What we tend to call fake law.
Most states have brought in guidelines on the use of AI in the courts, Each state has taken a different view on how restrictive its rules should be. New South Wales has prohibited the use of AI in creating witness statements and expert reports, while Victoria has called for caution rather than outright bans. Professor Michael Legg can understand why some courts have avoided more concrete rules.
Generative AI is still developing, and its capabilities and how it operates is changing. And so there is, I guess, a sort of a feeling that there are some things where generative AI can't do certain things at present in a reliable manner. And so you're sort of saying, well, no, we don't want you to use that. There's a concern, well, maybe that's going to be able to be overcome. And so I think it is trying to sort of take account of if there's a change in the technology or the way that it's being used, wanting to be able to adapt to that quickly.
A spokesperson for South Australia's Chief Justice says that state's guidelines are due to come into effect early next year. Marissa Mackey is the president of the Law Society of South Australia.
Because it can be a valuable tool, we'd like to see that it's not about prohibiting the use of artificial intelligence, but providing a framework in which the courts consider it can be used appropriately.
The federal court is yet to bring in AI guidelines. A spokesperson for the federal court says it's currently reviewing submissions as part of a review into its digital procedures.
Angus Randall there. Well, the world's most popular song contest, Eurovision, is in turmoil, with four countries pulling out of next year's competition to protest Israel's participation. Overnight, a vote was held to examine whether Israel could participate, and the ruling was in favour of keeping Israel in the contest. It comes as the international contest faces increasing scrutiny in recent years over a lack of transparency on how it decides the winners. Diana Damjanovic reports.
It's long been touted as a joyful celebration of global harmony through music, but politics is never far from the stage, and it's once again seeped into competition. Charles Joseph McGettigan won the contest for Ireland in 1994, one of four countries that have pulled out of next year's competition over the inclusion of Israel.
Now, at a crucial point in time, they've decided, yeah, we don't want to enter a competition that Israel is involved in. And, you know, it's particularly because at the moment, journalists can't go in to Gaza City. Nobody knows what's going on in there.
Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia have also declared they won't be in the 2026 contest. Taco Zimmerman is the Director General of the Dutch public broadcaster Avrotros.
It has everything to do with what we stand for, our values. And with that, there's no other decision to be made.
The move comes after the European Broadcasting Union, a group of 56 public broadcasters that run the event, met to discuss Israel's participation, which ultimately paved the way for Israel to participate. The outcome was welcomed by the interim head of the European Jewish Congress and vice president of the World Jewish Congress, Ariel Musikant.
First of all, it's the independent broadcaster that is participating, and I think that's a victory for Europe. It's a victory for common sense, and it's a defeat for all those who wanted to express their hatred of Israel here in a song contest where it has no place.
In this year's competition, Israel came second, amid allegations the scoring process was manipulated. Next year, there will be tougher voting rules. Associate Professor Jess Carnell is a Eurovision expert from the University of Southern Queensland.
They issued a new set of rules to their members, basically trying to mitigate any third-party or governmental interference into the song contest, particularly around voting, around whether or not Israel had used various tactics to boost up their popular vote.
Jess Carnell says even though the rules have been changed, people and groups can still pay for votes.
They've reduced the votes from 20 votes to 10 votes. And there are other limitations on how many votes you can give an individual country. So they're using things like that as a way of trying to reduce sort of big blocks of votes being made by fans or by accounts into Eurovision. But they haven't changed the way that you vote, which is by method of payment. That's how many numbers of votes that you get. So it's 10 votes per method of payment.
Associate Professor Jess Carnell is a Eurovision expert from the University of Southern Queensland, ending that report by Diana Damjanovic. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. The US has been building up its military forces in the Caribbean after months of deadly strikes on boats from Venezuela, it says, are smuggling drugs. Today, Latin America expert Orlando Perez on why Donald Trump is turning up the pressure on Venezuela's president and if it could edge the region towards conflict. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.